Thanks there to Sam Davis for In Your Company. In 30 minutes, there's Hispanic Voices about culture in Spain. But first, let's hear what science adds to culture in this week's Science Show.
Welcome to the Science Show on Cambridge 105. Today, we look at what happens when crops, like wheat, leave the farm. In the case of wheat, the seed would have been planted in October or possibly spring if it was spring wheat, and we take up the story at the harvest of the crops in August. We visit a storage facility where the produce from hundreds of farms are taken by lorry to be tested, stored, and ultimately sold to major bakeries and brand names. And as you'll hear in a moment, there's a lot of science along the way.
Find out what happens in the industry after this bit of a tune.
This is the Science Show on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city. We start with a hello from me, Roger Frost, and not just me, but another voice we'll be introducing in today's show. Here with me is Neil Ainsbury. Nice to have you back, Neil.
Thank you, Roger. Hello, yes, I'm Neil, here to remind you that this is the show with 30 minutes of the kind of science that happens in the world of work and that they never told us about in school. And as we're here in Cambridge, England, we've got a special focus on the sciencey things that have been happening here in town.
Well, today's guest scientist works on the science side of Camgrain, a firm which takes credit as the largest central grain storage operation in the UK. I visited one of their facilities. There are several in the middle regions of the UK, and I found myself in a massive depot, one that I had unknowingly passed many times on the road, even though it was hidden away in the fields of Cambridgeshire.
So our scientist is Dr. Andrew Wingate, who'll be telling us how Camgrain ensure that the grain that they store, sell, and ultimately comes to us, is entirely fit for purpose. Camgrain have a clean wheat plant that prepares the grain for food production, yet they hold a Grade A food standard rating from the British Retail Consortium. That's a rating which is a requirement of many food manufacturers in the industry.
That's good. A clean wheat plant. So what's a plant for wheat plants? So is it just me that thinks a piece of machinery in the industry ought not to be a plant?
How about we dump that word?
We'll dump that word.
Good. Anyway, as we've said, with the quality standards set high, it'd be a tough call for an individual farmer to get their wheat up to standard and to get involved in the selling of their crop. Surely they want to focus on growing the stuff.
Yes, they do. So 20 years ago, Camgrain was set up to help. They are a farmer-owned central storage cooperative. Camgrain would offer the farmers not only to store their grain, but also to provide facilities for analysing, cleaning and distributing to sectors of the food industry, you know, the firms that do milling, brewing and making breakfast cereal. It's a lot to do with offering efficiency and improving quality, as we'll now hear from Andrew Wingate. I started by asking Andy to explain where Camgrain fits in the supply chain.
As far as I know, a farmer grows wheat, and next I buy some flour from a shop. So where does Camgrain fit in?
It's a farmer-owned central storage co-op, and where we fit in is that we offer a storage solution for farmers, but we're also operating to improve the efficiency of the supply chain to get a better deal for the UK farmers. You get economies of scale. We are able to guarantee the product that we are delivering to the processor, which really turns the industry on its head. Traditionally, a farmer would have a contract with a merchant. That merchant would come and sample the grain on his farm. He would sort of walk over the heap that he's got in his barn, take a few samples with a spear, do the analysis. The key analysis on wheat that they're looking at is protein, okay, moisture, falling Hagberg number, and density, also referred to as bushel weight or hectolitre. In recent years, there's also been a bigger focus on mycotoxins as well, which is very important, especially when it's concerning with food use, because these are the toxins that are left over from a fungal infection that can occur on the wheat if the weather's not favourable.
Okay, ergot and stuff.
So the farmer is then delivering his grain to a mill, because the merchant is there just to match up the two, effectively, like a dating service, if you like. He'll buy the grain from the farmer at one price, and he's obviously selling it on at a different price. But at the end of the day, the people that are buying the grain are going to have to come and collect it from the farmer, deliver it to the mill. The farmer can't afford to have a laboratory, but there'll be a laboratory at the mill at the intake, and they're checking very carefully exactly what the farmer's delivered, because traditionally in the agricultural industry, it's very much a sort of a buyer beware approach. Because the farmers haven't been able to have big facilities for checking very accurately every single load that's going out, then the mills have always needed to, because they need to check what is the actual quality they're getting. The farmer will do his absolute best to get those quality criteria within the parameters that he knows he should for the contract he's signed with his merchant, but it's in the lap of the gods because of the weather and various other things. There's all sorts of inputs you can put onto the grain to get the protein where it needs to be, but at the end of the day, you need to test what you've grown, because you can't guarantee a quality on a particular field.
It's not always wheat. Farmers don't plant the same crop every year. The farmer then rotates the crop.
Exactly. So the farmer will, on a particular field, he'll have a rotation. Could be 1 year wheat, the next year wheat, then the next year oilseed rape, and then back to wheat again. The different land types would indicate a different kind of rotation. And there's a specific industry of advisors called agronomists that farmers would speak to get the advice or do the training themselves to understand their soil type and what's going to produce the best profit for their farming business on that patch of land. But it all comes down to the fact that if you were just to grow one crop continuously, you might deplete the soil from the particular nutrients that that crop type needs. That might require more inputs that you're going to have to buy. But more importantly, that you might get a build-up of diseases and pests that are specific to that crop type. If you don't have a break crop and put something else in there, then you might get this build-up of disease, and you'll get lower and lower yields and possibly lower and lower quality. At the end of the day, farmers are all businessmen, and they want to maximise their profits.
Okay. Around us, we see great big containers with all these various seeds, but you're not simply a storage organisation.
The farmer isn't particularly aware of all the quality of his grain. I mean, he's got a rough idea from a few samples they took, but they will load up a lorry, 29 tonnes, off it goes to the mill. They will analyse that very carefully.
Yes.
And they may come back to him and say, well, actually, the quality on this load is this, this and this. And it's supposed to be that, that and that. And if you fall below the requirement, then you're going to get paid less money for it. And he'll get the phone call, are you willing to accept less money for your load? And it's a difficult position for the farmer, because, you know, what can he do? He's up against a big, you know, big company, basically. He may have to take the knock, or, you know, the alternative, which is even worse, is that the mill say, well, actually, the quality's so far out that we actually can't accept it at all. And so all the cost of that delivery is going to come back to the farmer, and he's going to have to try and get it tipped off somewhere else, which is a very pressure situation. But Camgrain, where we fit into the supply chain, is to try and turn that model on its head. So that's a very much price taker, sort of confrontational model. And with our partners, we're trying to have a very much more collaborative approach. So for example, on the Sainsbury's supply chain contract, where Camgrain farmers provide all of the wheat that's milled into flour for all of the in-store baked products in Sainsbury's to keep the whole thing sort of in the UK, if you like. In that supply chain, so every single load comes in from the Camgrain farmers at harvest time. We test every single load coming in on all the major criteria to check the quality. We will then store that appropriately, you know, the better quality stuff and the stuff that doesn't quite meet the grade, etc. We'll be able to segregate it to maximise the value of every single load. And then when we deliver it out, we will blend to ensure that the quality that's being delivered to the mill is exactly the quality that the miller wants. And there's a huge benefit to the miller to have a consistent quality on every single load throughout the season. So he can set up his mill to the parameters of what he's expecting, and he doesn't have to invest so much in intake infrastructure and storage on his facility. He can invest in milling capacity, which is his core business activity, and he can get the consistent product coming through. And we, for example, we test all the products that come out of Camgrain sites. You know, we test them before we release them, and if they're not within spec according to our laboratory analysis, we don't let the lorry go down the road. And so we've got to a situation where you build trust with the people you're supplying to, and so they use our test analysis.
You mentioned one or two tests we'd never heard of.
So I'll walk you through what happens in the lab when the lorry comes in. So the lorry pulls onto the weighbridge. So the first thing it's doing there is we're measuring the weight of the lorry, pretty basic. There's a robotic arm which comes out over the lorry, spears down to the bottom of the lorry, and then there's a vacuum process that then sucks grain. So you get a representative sample all the way from the bottom of the lorry to the top.
Okay.
And this is getting into the realms of statistics for a correct sample. You know, this is very important. And then this robotic arm will do this a couple of times. to get a good few spear points, and you'll get about 5 kgs of sample, I suppose, into the lab. And again, all about getting the sample to be homogeneous. We have these sort of splitting devices that you pour the grain into, and it divides it up, so you don't get a sort of a slug of one bit of the sample going into one machine and a slug of another bit into the sample. It's a bit like shuffling the deck, if you like, of the grain. So you get your homogeneous sample, and the first machine they'll put that into is usually an NIR machine, near infrared reflectance analysis machine. And what that's doing is, it's a very rapid analysis, which is obviously very convenient for our business here, because we want to maximise the turnaround.
Quick answer.
We want to know the analysis straight away, because we want to know where to tip that lorry. So this machine will measure the moisture content, which is incredibly important, because grain has a specific moisture content at which it should be stored. So you have to obviously dry it if it's too wet. You're going to measure the protein, oil or nitrogen content. The protein level is very important. You know, higher protein is better, lower protein is not so good. And when you're delivering the wheat, the protein level is one of the specifications. You know, bread making wheat, 13% protein.
Yes.
And then the density of the grain will affect the extraction rate at the mill. So that's another criteria they have on the contracts. There'll be a minimum density that they're willing to accept. So if you fall below that density, they might, you know, they'll pay you less money, or they might not accept it. So those are three very important analyses that we're able to analyse very quickly with the machine, the tech, as it's called. Then the other important analysis that takes a little bit longer is the falling Hagberg number. The moisture, obviously, that's water content. It's just percentage. The protein is a percentage. And the density is kilograms per hectolitre. And it affects the extraction rate. A low density grain means that there's going to be a lot of husk and probably very little endosperm. So endosperm, if you cut a grain in half, you've got the sort of, there's a husk on the outside, the bran. There's a sort of a large sort of white area, which is the endosperm. That's what becomes flour. And a low density grain will have husk, but very little endosperm. High density grain will probably have more endosperm. So it affects the extraction rate. So the amount of tons of wheat you put down the hole in the mill versus the amount of tons of flour come out the other end. Low density grain, you got less flour, so the miller's, you know, losing money, if you like.
Of course.
So that's why it's important.
And tell us about this falling German name.
Falling Hagberg number. The Hagberg is a test that determines how good that wheat will be for producing flour. You take your sample of grain, you grind it up into a powder, you mix it with a fixed volume of distilled water, a specific weight of wheat that goes into the process, and it's a specific sized mixing vessel, and there's a specifically sized plunger. It then goes into a machine that's set at a specific temperature, and then the mixing takes place. The gluten that's present in the flour, basically, that you've made in a very sort of coarse way, is mixing with the water, and it will produce a sort of a gelatinous solution. And then you let that plunger fall through the solution. And the more viscous the solution is, the slower the plunger will fall. And that is the falling number. So the falling number is the number of seconds that the plunger takes to get to the bottom of the test tube.
Okay.
So why is this important?
Okay.
One way to measure the grain coming in would be to make a loaf out of it. But that's the ultimate reference, I suppose. But you know, we haven't got time to do that. We need to know the answer in 5 minutes.
Oh.
So a chap called Sven Hagberg created this method. The important thing that goes from a sample that's good for bread making flour to a sample that's bad for bread making flour is the fact that the seed has started to go down the process of germination. It started to produce the enzymes that it needs to break down those starches to glucose so it can use it in a respiratory process.
Yes.
Okay. And these enzymes, alpha amylase, they're the ones that cut the long carbohydrate chains up into shorter chains and into single sugar units.
Yes.
If you take a sample of grain that's been allowed to go a bit too far, then the seed has produced this alpha amylase, and then when you make your solution for the Hagberg test, the enzyme in those seeds is getting released, and it's slicing up all the starch chains to smaller sugar units, and then it's producing a less viscous solution. If you were then to use that flour to actually make a dough, that would directly correlate with the ability of the dough to rise or not.
You alluded to the fact that some of these tests are fairly quick. Can you give us an idea of the kind of fairly quick?
Protein and the moisture and the bushel weight and the hardness, that all goes into a sort of single instrument, and that measures that within 30 seconds or so.
Oh, wow.
The Hagberg test is slightly longer because you've got that mixing process, but it's about 5 minutes.
So a vehicle could arrive and you'd know within 5 minutes that...
Absolutely. That's the intention, to get the vehicles turned around as rapidly as possible. The key element on Hagberg, which is different from all the others, is if you have, for example, a load that is 30 tonnes at 16% moisture, and you've got a load at 14% moisture, you know, if you blend the two together perfectly, the moisture will equal out and you'll have 15% moisture because it's weight for weight. Well, with Hagberg, it's a very different story, because Hagberg, you're measuring an enzyme activity. And importantly, if you had a sample of 50 Hagberg wheat, it's going to be very poor for bread making. If you mix that sample of 50 Hagberg wheat with 300 Hagberg wheat, you potentially would have an entire bulk of 50 Hagberg.
Yes.
because the enzyme activity could be hundreds of thousands of times higher in the seed with the 50 Hagberg than the seed with the 300 Hagberg. If you're going to blend Hagberg, it's not like for like, because the enzyme activity affects that.
Got it. What I saw was a whole bunch of seeds running through shoots.
This is a wheat cleaning plant. It basically enables us to take wheat from a sort of a standard tradable commodity into a human food use ingredient. In Camgrain, what we do is we take the soft wheat that's delivered in by our members and we'll put it through this cleaning process, which really just ensures that the grain is absolutely clean and ensures that the right size of grain is there for the customer, and there's no sort of dust or sand, and all those sorts of things are all removed.
Tell us about some of the sort of modules.
There's a series of processes. There's a sort of sieving stage, and then there's a process that sort of polishes the grain. All the while, there's air aspiration taking the dust and the chaff away from the process. The key step in all of this is the colour sorter that sits at the very bottom of the process. And this incredible bit of machinery works a bit like in a lab you might have a flow cytometer measuring cells. Well, it's a similar sort of idea to that. Effectively, you have a wall of grain, like a waterfall, one grain thick, falling past a series of thousands of tiny cameras. And what this machine does is it's able to photograph every single grain. And the computer software behind that, you'll have built in the specification. So you've built in the specification for colour, for example. So if there's a grain that's the wrong colour, below the cameras are a series of air jets. So the camera detects a grain that's not suitable for the specification, the air jet will blast that grain the other side of the divide. So you've got the grain that you're accepting and the grain that you're rejecting as two options. And this thing runs at 20 tonnes an hour and sort of controls the whole process. And it allows you to have very, very good separation of the grains you do want and the grains you don't want. And we use that for sorting the colour. But it's also very important because it enables us to give very good assurance that we're able to remove non-ferrous items. For example, you would have metal checkers for checking for ferrous and non-ferrous metals.
Okay.
But what about something like glass? Should a glass ever get into the process?
How is that found?
Is going to have a very different response on the camera than a piece of grain.
Okay.
You have to have these processes in place to ensure the quality. The grain that comes out of Camgrain goes straight to the factory where they're going to make the actual breakfast cereals, and it goes straight onto their production line.
Yeah.
All of these systems are in place, not just the machinery, the nuts and bolts, but the assurance, and it's referred to HACCP, the critical control point analysis, is all in place to ensure the quality.
So there is a lab here.
Yes,
going back to that.
That's right. All of the Camgrain sites have laboratories, so we're taking the samples of the grain on the way in to do all our bank of analyses on it to check the quality. So our farmer who's sent in his loads of grain, he can go online and check the quality of the grain he sent in. Now, this is incredibly useful for him because he might be combining in a field. He sent in a few loads from it already. He picks up his iPhone and sees that maybe he's lost the Hagberg on that field. What he's combining there, he's planted a group one, bread making, wanting to get the best money for it. But actually, it turns out because of the weather or other conditions that actually the Hagberg's gone on this field. So he can decide at that point, well, I'll stop on this field, I'll move to another field. It allows him to respond. Also, looking at all the loads that he sent in, he can see the protein levels. He can adjust his scheme for his inputs for the next year. If he's way overshot the protein mark, perhaps spent too much on inputs, maybe he can reduce his inputs. The data is incredibly useful for the farmers as well to understand the quality of the grain they're producing, to refine their own processes, as well as obviously when we're delivering it, we need to know the quality that's going out so we meet all the specifications of people that are purchasing the grain.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Thanks there to Dr. Andrew Wingate of Camgrain. Thanks, Andy, for giving up time at what is a crazily busy time of the year.
So what do you think, Neil?
So did Andy tell you about the different varieties of wheat?
Yeah, I heard that in this country we classify the wheat according to the NABIM system. That's NABIM. It's a national body. And out of 40 varieties of wheat, and by the way, despite what you might imagine, none of these varieties of wheat are GM crops. There are no GM wheat crops grown commercially anywhere in the world. Anyway, these 40 varieties are then put into four groups. There's a group one variety, which is the best stuff for milling and baking, and just behind that are the group two varieties that can also be used for making bread. Most of us know these group one and group two flours as strong flours. After that, you've the group three varieties, which are soft flours for making biscuits and cakes. The group four varieties of wheat are the types of wheat really used to feed animals, and about 40% of the UK's crop goes to feed chickens and cows and pigs.
Okay, so that's what they're for, but what's the difference between strong and wheat flours?
The difference is to do with keeping the bubbles in your bread. It's as simple as that. Mm. Hard or strong wheat flour means the same thing. These flours produce a dough which is elastic because it has a high gluten or protein content. If you've got a bag of strong bread-making flour in the cupboard, you'll see now that 12 or 14% of it is protein. That's on the label. It's high in gluten. So, go back to basics now. Yeast grows on the sugar in the dough. It uses the sugar to respire. It makes carbon dioxide bubbles, which makes the bread rise. And gluten is in there like a chewing gum, and it's holding the carbon dioxide gas bubbles to produce a spongy loaf. And it gives it a good shape until the loaf is set and baked. If that goes wrong, in other words, you use the wrong flour, or you forget the yeast, or you forget the sugar, you end up without bubbles, and you end up with something hard, like a house brick, which some of us have probably made once.
So what about the soft flour?
Soft flour has less gluten, and baking with it gives you a crumbly, less chewy kind of cakey kind of texture. Soft flour ranges from cake flour, which is the lowest in gluten, to pastry flour, which is has a bit more gluten than cake flour.
Okay, gluten then. I'm hearing about gluten an awful lot of the time. Gluten-free products, gluten-free diets. What actually is gluten?
Well, gluten, as we've said, is mostly the protein part of the wheat, and it makes the bread dough elastic, helping it rise and hold its shape. We said that it gives the final product a chewy texture, and the clue is that the word gluten is a Latin word meaning glue. So gluten is not only found in wheat, it's found in barley, it's found in rye, but it's not found in rice, which is good news for those who are sensitive to gluten because they eat rice.
Good to know. Thank you. Well, what we'll do, we'll put the links to Camgrain on our podcast page. And also, if you have a look back through the podcasts, you're going to find a fascinating story about a company that develops better wheat seed for farmers. Right now, it's time to hear what Daniel's been thinking about. But not before a jingle.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
If you were listening over the summer, you'd have been introduced to our guest Science Show presenter, Daniel Edward. This week, he's been sat in his kitchen musing about his microwave oven. He says microwaves don't like metal, but as he says, the thing's made of metal.
I'm sure you, just like the rest of us, have been told at some point or another that you can't put metal in a microwave. Well, I'm currently in my kitchen, having a rather late lunch, it's true, and I'm just about to put my beans into my microwave. Well, I have taken them out of the metal can, and I'm not leaving any metal items in there, but I could. And this is because, well, let's face it, a microwave is made out of metal. So we shouldn't really be that surprised that some metal can go into microwaves. Now, what would happen if this offending metal came into contact with a microwave? We all know, we've all been told that there'd be large sparks and it'll be potentially dangerous and damaging to the microwave. So why can you have a metal thing which is unable to cope with metal? Well, the walls inside a microwave form a Faraday cage, and this is a completely closed off unit that traps microwaves inside, and there is no opportunity for them to escape. Now, my microwave, and I would imagine yours as well, has holes in a grid formation at the front so that I can see in to see how my my beans are getting on. And you'd imagine that this would be an issue. Surely the microwaves would escape, but apparently not. And this is because the microwaves are actually larger than the holes that have been cut into the sheet of metal, the metal grid that's in front of the microwave oven. So whilst light rays can get through, microwaves can't. Otherwise, you'd get a pretty burnt face from looking in to see how your food's getting on. Well, microwaves are magnetrons hooked up to high voltage sources, and then the microwaves themselves bounce around inside the box until absorbed by something, and water or ceramics are particularly good at turning microwaves into heat. Metals, on the other hand, as we all know, are conductors of electricity, and they're pretty damn good ones at that. So they move around, they've got electrons that move around freely on the surface. And so, dependent on the shape of the metal, this may turn into heat in a microwave, or it might not at all. And this is why it is possible to have metal in your microwave, so long as it is the right shape. You may also see some arcing of electricity. Now, why is this, and why has this warning come about that you should only use microwave-safe metals or even plastics? Well, the microwaves would hit the metal, and then the free electrons on the surface become highly active. This prevents the path of the microwave itself and causes the waves to be reflected instead of being absorbed. This isn't an issue in itself, that's exactly what the microwave oven itself is doing with its metal walls. But if you have an irregular shaped piece of metal, such as a fork with its, you know, multiple prongs, or even a piece of tinfoil if you've forgotten to take that out, then the irregular form of it is going to send microwaves reflecting off in all different directions, and that's when you'll get this electric arcing, which could, in certain cases, lead to large and damaging sparks from the offending metal to another electrical conductor with a lower potential, which is very often the microwave wall. And that's why you would get that loud bang and perhaps a black scarring on your microwave, which might make it unsafe to use. So whilst it is safe to use some metals of some shapes in your microwave, I would still recommend that you only use ones which say specifically on it, safe for microwave ovens, because even though scientifically it may be fine, you never know what slight irregularities are in your metal. And that is why, for my beans, I wasn't going to take the risk.
Thank you, Daniel Edward. Thanks for helping us to use physics to stay safe in the kitchen. I'm really glad you resisted the temptation to be reckless with your microwave.
But we really should have more kitchen science.
Yes, indeed. Coincidentally, there was a World War II kind of drama on the TV the other week, and it was about the development of radar, which was used to give advance warning of when the enemy aeroplanes were heading over England in the Second World War.
Right, so the connection with microwaves?
The connection is to do with aircraft radar and microwave ovens using the same sorts of radio waves, but they're using them for different jobs. The first microwave oven, in fact, came out of the Second World War radar technology. It was on sale, I found out, in 1946, and it cost, in today's money, $50,000. So it took another 30 years before the price came down to make it a sort of cheapy mass market.
Yeah, well, there you go. Thanks, Roger.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
And that's pretty much all for today's Science Show on Cambridge 105. In a few days' time, you'll find a podcast recording of the show at our website, www.cambridge105.fm.
And you can now pick up our podcast on iTunes. Just search for 105 Science. Our next show on Cambridge 105 will be 2 weeks on Saturday at 2:30 p.m.
If you want a reminder of that, follow us on the Twitter at 105 Science. And if you have a science event to promote or you've got a question about science, you can email us on the email science@cambridge105.fm.
And that leaves us to say many thanks to Andy Wingate from Camgrain, and also, of course, Daniel Edward. So I'll say bye from me, Neil Ainsby.
And bye from me, Roger Frost.
Coming up next, Hispanic Voices.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.